Hey, I'm Brian Stelter, host of Inside the Hive from Vanity Fair. This week, I'm talking with author Dave Cullen about the 25th anniversary of the Columbine Massacre.
Well, I think the anniversaries are a good time to just stop and take stock, because normally we're seeing things in isolation. And 10 years out, 20 years out, especially 25 years out, it's really good to step back and see, like, okay, what has this wrought?
Where are we now? What's changed? What hasn't? What should? Join me, Brian Stelter, on Inside the Hive from Vanity Fair. Listen wherever you get podcasts.
A warning for listeners. Throughout this podcast, we have descriptions and recreations of terrorism, plus some harsh language. It's important history to hear, but it can also be disturbing. I started reporting on the FBI and the war on terror in the years after 9/11, writing first about the then little-known FBI director, a man named Robert Mueller. Later, I wrote a book that traced the 40-year rise of the FBI's counterterrorism program. And over the course of that reporting, I spoke with nearly everyone who played a major role in the Bureau's counterterrorism work since the 1980s. Everyone, that is, except for one man, John O'Neill. I never got a chance to meet O'Neill, but I finished my book feeling like I knew him. After all, seemingly anyone who worked in the FBI, the U.S. government, or tons more who just lived in New York City in the 1990s, they all seemed to have a John O'Neill story. He was friends with the Cardinal and a raconteur at the city's famed watering hole, Elaine's. Not exactly the usual profile for an FBI special agent. Steve Gauden is full of John O'Neill stories. He spent over two decades in the FBI and reported to O'Neill in the late 1990s.
John was a very flamboyant person, is the best way I could describe him. He was always dressed, what we would say in my neighborhood, he was dressed to the nines all the time, even in occasions where you didn't need to be dressed that way. If you saw him at 2 in the morning, which was not uncommon, or if you saw him at 2 in the afternoon, he looked exactly the same.
In the years since the attacks, John O'Neill has been featured in countless books and documentaries about 9/11. Actors Jeff Daniels and Harvey Keitel have portrayed him. The New Yorker profiled him in 2002 simply as the counterterrorist, and PBS's Frontline called him the man who knew. He's become a popular character for many reasons. First, in some ways, he personified the G-Men. This is from a 1997 interview with O'Neill, one of the few he ever gave.
During a career in law enforcement, during a career in national security issues, unfortunately you do see occasionally the dark side, but that you constantly look for the good in people, the good side of life, and the reasons why you do what you do, and to do it under the rule of law, to do it every single day, to protect people's constitutional rights, their civil rights, but at the same time protect them from all the bad things that are out there.
John O'Neill was known for a relentless approach to his cases. For years in the 1990s, the FBI had been looking for Ramzi Youssef, who was behind the 1993 World Trade Center bombing. But he escaped the Bureau's grasp in New York and fled the country.
Born in Kuwait, he's fluent in three languages and teased his pursuers by frequently changing identities and appearance.
The manhunt became so intense, the FBI and State Department flooded the Middle East with thousands of these matchbooks written in Arabic, offering a $2 million reward for Youssef's arrest.
There really was a hopelessness that he would never be caught and never be seen again.
Then lightning struck. The weekend that O'Neill took over as the FBI counterterrorism chief in 1995, U.S. intelligence found out Youssef would be out in the open for one night. White House counterterrorism head Richard Clark got the tip on a Sunday and called over to the FBI. "Who's this?" Clark asked when an unfamiliar voice answered the phone. He heard back, "I'm John O'Neill. Who the fuck are you?" The agent wasn't supposed to start work until Tuesday morning, but O'Neill had driven straight to FBI headquarters from an old post in Chicago to get a jump start on the work. That first conversation would become the start of the legend of John O'Neill. For days, he worked the phones from the FBI's Hoover building, helping to coordinate a complex trap on the other side of the world. And within 24 hours, Ramzi Youssef was in U.S. handcuffs in Pakistan.
Ramzi Youssef was staying in a boarding house. His hair dyed red this time when police kicked in the door. The world's most sought-after terrorist went quietly, agents say. They also say he was planning another bombing attack.
Another reason John O'Neill is such a popular character in the retelling of 9/11 is the same reason Hollywood latched onto him. By all reports, he was stubborn and confrontational. In the late 90s, O'Neill rose through the Bureau's ranks and assumed control of the New York office's counterterrorism work. But along the way, he became an outspoken pariah, someone who couldn't play well with others. Most famously, he clashed with Barbara Bodine, the U.S. ambassador to Yemen in 2000. O'Neill was there investigating the Al-Qaeda attack on a Navy ship, the USS Cole. He insisted the Yemeni government wasn't cooperating and couldn't be trusted. Here's a clip from The Looming Tower, Hulu's adaptation of the book by Lawrence Wright. Jeff Daniels portrays O'Neill arguing with Bodine, played by Jennifer Ely.
Every move you have made since you've arrived has offended every man, woman, and organization you've come in contact with. You make enemies, not progress, here in my country.
In your country, the United States? We're citizens of a country that offers so much, the rest of the world either wants to be us or kill us.
My goal is to make sure Yemen is the former.
17 dead Americans, and their blood's gonna be on your hands.
Don't talk to me about
it. Make the fucking phone call, Bodine. Diplomacy will recover. Those sailors are gone forever.
In a 2006 op-ed, Bodine downplayed any alleged feud with him. She wrote, "I'm not here to either defend or attack O'Neill. He was a complex man." Part of what drove John O'Neill's almost bullying approach was that counterterrorism was hardly the FBI's top priority before 9/11. At every turn, he was trying to convince agents, supervisors, and even bureau leadership that counterterrorism work was important. He even had to originally convince agents like Steve Gauden, who would become one of the most important members of his team in later years. Gauden had joined the Bureau after 6 years in the Army's 82nd Airborne. A job at the FBI, Gauden thought, might give him the adrenaline rush he still craved. But instead, he'd ended up in upstate New York, working out of a two-man office in a strip mall above a Dunkin' Donuts. The office didn't even have a working typewriter, so they had to handwrite their reports. By 1997, Gauden was desperate for a better job. So desperate, he was even willing to consider working with O'Neill in the New York field office.
And I was a little suspect because I remember going through the academy, the ongoing threat, if you did something wrong, if you didn't pass this test, if you didn't do well in firearms, if you did something, well, we're going to ship you off to New York, which made it seem like a place you never wanted to go. And then, of course, my being from inner city Boston, why would I ever want to go to New York with all the rivalries between the Red Sox, the Yankees, the Bruins, and the Rangers, etc.? But after talking to him and knowing he had my best interest at heart, I decided to go and give it a try. And that's how I ended up in New York.
But once he got there, Steve still felt he was languishing, working security and logistics for the 1998 Goodwill Games, a sort of mini-Olympics backed by Ted Turner. Gauden hated it, but he impressed John O'Neill.
I had done criminal work when I was in Albany, and I wanted to get back to doing that. It was felt to me more action and fast pace. And what John O'Neill said to me was, "Trust me, you do a good job on this, and I'm going to make you happy."
And that brings us to the last and by far biggest reason O'Neill is an FBI legend. While unraveling the terrorist cell around Ramzi Youssef, O'Neill started hearing another name, Osama bin Laden. Most intelligence at the time said bin Laden was only a financier of terror. But O'Neill sensed he was up to more. He would stay up at night in his New York apartment watching videotapes of the soft-spoken terrorist who had declared war on America in the mid-1990s.
Miller questioned bin Laden about the disturbing fatwa targeting American civilians. Bin Laden fired back.
American history does not distinguish between civilians and military, not even women and children. They're the ones who used the bombs against Nagasaki and Hiroshima. The fatwa applies to all those who assist and support in killing the sons of Muslims.
On the morning of September 11, 2001, the name Osama bin Laden was still unknown to most Americans. But the U.S. government knew a lot. That was because of investigations by John O'Neill and his counterterrorism colleagues, who had spent the previous years chasing al-Qaeda across the globe. The CIA had also found that two of the eventual hijackers had entered the United States. And the system, CIA Director George Tenet would later say, was blinking red. But as we all know, the attacks unfolded anyway.
The unthinkable happened today. The World Trade Center, both towers, gone.
The casualty figures will be numbing.
Our way of life, our very freedom, came under attack in a series of deliberate and deadly terrorist acts.
In the days and weeks after 9/11, as rescuers and volunteers pulled victims from the rubble of the World Trade Center, John O'Neill's story met a tragic and ironic end. His body was found in the rubble at Ground Zero. The years after 9/11 were full of investigations, inquiries, and hearings all centered around one question. What went wrong? How did the U.S. government, as the saying became, fail to connect the dots? Years later, Richard Clark, the same man who called John O'Neill that night in 95 and who worked with him for years, famously said this while testifying before the 9/11 Commission.
Your government failed you. Those entrusted with protecting you failed you. And I failed you.
Commissioner Jamie Gorelick sat across from Clark in that hearing.
And he turned around to the 9/11 victims' families who were in the hearing room behind him and apologized. He was, in essence, calling for others to say the same thing, but to my recollection, no one else did.
I'm Garrett Graff, a journalist, historian, and author of the New York Times best-selling book, The Only Plane in the Sky, An Oral History of 9/11. I've spent much of the last two decades studying and reporting on that tragedy and how it changed our world. But as we near the 20th anniversary of the attacks, it's clear that many people still don't understand what happened that day. From Longlead and Goat Rodeo, this is Long Shadow, a podcast about the enduring mysteries and lingering questions of 9/11. Episode 5, How a Lost Summer, Bureaucratic Red Tape, and Stubborn Pride Set the Stage for a Successful Terrorist Attack on 9/11. To find out how, we'll take a deep dive into the years-long investigation by the FBI and John O'Neill into al-Qaeda, the terrorist organization that in the end found him first. So why didn't the FBI, the CIA, or any of the intelligence agencies or the military stop the attacks before they happened? The answer is complicated. I'll start by saying a couple of words and see what images come to mind. Ready? Here we go. G-Men. The Bureau. Special agents. What did you think of? Maybe you picture slick crime fighters crisscrossing the United States to solve the country's most vital cases, to chase public enemy number one.
FBI!
When I say CIA, maybe you imagine covert surveillance, acts of international cat and mouse, espionage that straddles the boundaries of what's legal and morally acceptable. But I'm going to tell you today about another version of U.S. intelligence, particularly the counterterrorism apparatus that existed before 9/11, before the war on terror, before the idea of homeland security, before Kiefer Sutherland's 24 or Claire Danes' Homeland. The truth is that for a long time, the hardworking FBI special agents and CIA officers tasked with counterterrorism had been overwhelmed and understaffed. This version of U.S. counterterrorism, the one that ultimately ground down John O'Neill and agents like him, was viewed by intel folks as a career killer and a dead end, and it barely resembles the intelligence system that has been put in place since 9/11. The momentum and money an FBI investigation brings, in man hours, forensics, technology, it can be practically unstoppable. But historically, the Bureau has only been able to focus on a few big problems at a time. In unguarded moments, many agents and supervisors will admit that the Bureau solves what it wants to solve. And for most of its existence, that hasn't been terrorism. Since the days of J. Edgar Hoover, the nation's premier domestic law enforcement agency focused on crime.
Soldiers in war while the world is at peace. The victorious war that the G-men have waged against organized crime. What mystery is there behind that triumph of law? Let's see. Let's ask J. Edgar Hoover, who as a young attorney became in 1924 director of the G-men.
There is nothing mysterious about the manner in which the Federal Bureau of Investigation works. Its formula is a simple one. Intensive training, carefully investigated, and highly efficient personnel, plus rigid requirements in regard to conduct, intelligence, and integrity.
The Bureau ran down bank robbers, it foiled kidnappings, unmasked fraudsters, and busted corrupt politicians.
The nerve center of the FBI, the kidnap switchboard. Day and night it waits for the alarm in kidnapping and other dangerous crimes. Over this teletype were sent the orders in the hunt for Dillinger, Babyface Nelson, Pretty Boy Floyd, the Barker Carpus mob, and those other notorious public enemies.
This meant that counterterrorism was largely an afterthought at the Bureau, even after the 1993 bombing of the World Trade Center. The terrorism that the public knew was largely homegrown, not foreign.
That there are strong links between the three bombings in Atlanta.
Federal agents have taken into custody a man they suspect as the Unabomber.
A massive car bomb exploded outside of a large federal building in downtown Oklahoma City.
As the 1990s ended, the FBI's counterterrorism resources had actually dwindled by nearly 20%, dropping to just over 500 agents nationwide. John O'Neill led the counterterrorism team based in the New York field office, which was, by all accounts, the nation's top FBI counterterror unit. It was the first to focus on bin Laden and this new Islamic extremist group known as Al-Qaeda. The saying among agents at the New York office was, quote, "It wasn't bullshit until you proved it bullshit." Steve Gauden had spent that summer of 98 as the Bureau's liaison for the Goodwill Games. He was hoping, after, that as O'Neill promised, he'd be able to move on to a job that was actually interesting, like working a task force chasing bank robbers or drug dealers. It looked like he might get his chance when the games ended with no hiccups. After, Gauden took a much-needed vacation, excited finally about his brighter future at the Bureau.
So one day or 2 days into my vacation, I'm down on the Jersey Shore having a good time. Maybe too good of a time one night, and I get a phone call early the next morning on August 7th saying, wherever you are, get in your car and get back to the command post right away. I left where I was, the beach house I was, so fast, I didn't even take the radio plate that I had for my car to put the radio, to be able to function the radio. I thought something had happened with the Goodwill Games and that I was in trouble. There was some sort of I didn't dot or T I didn't cross, and I needed to get back to the office. So I drive the hour and a half it takes me. No idea really what's going on. No information in the car because I had left that radio faceplate. And I get into the command post, and I got my bathing suit and a tank top on. Chuck Fromm and John O'Neill meet me. They said, well, at least you dressed for the occasion. And I said, hey, I was told to get right in here. I knew it was serious. I came right away. And that's when O'Neill looked at Chuck and said, all right, brief him, tell him what we need, and let's get going. And John went to man the phones that he was calling with headquarters the whole time. And Chuck sits me down and said, hey, look, you're not married. You got no kids. We need people who can just pick up and go right now. Two of our embassies were attacked. Do you want to go to Nairobi or to Dar es Salaam?
Those explosions set to go off at the U.S. embassies in Dar es Salaam, Tanzania, and Nairobi, Kenya, were clearly a part of someone's war against the United States, although it is still unclear at this hour who our enemy is.
John O'Neill watched the news of the embassy bombings from New York. He didn't need to be anywhere near Africa to know who had carried out the attacks. This was bin Laden and Al-Qaeda. Within the FBI, he lobbied for his New York agents to be deployed to Africa to investigate the bombings. but the Bureau's leadership in the nation's capital wasn't convinced. They wanted to send the agents from the Washington field office who typically investigated cases in Africa.
I didn't really appreciate it at the time, but I could remember being in the command post and hearing O'Neill arguing on the phone with the director of the FBI. So to hear somebody calling the director by his first name was something new to me. And it seemed to be almost like a persuasion that O'Neill was trying to say, you know, this is our case. You know, this is our case. This belongs to New York.
The argument was that the New York field office was where the first case file on Al-Qaeda had been opened, making it, in the FBI's parlance, the office of origin going forward. This would end up being a recurring theme in the lead up to 9/11. Leadership in Washington at the CIA, FBI, and the White House, who trusted their own instincts over the agents and officers on the ground. Eventually, O'Neill's New York agents, including Godin, went to Africa. Godin was asked which site he wanted to go to, Dar es Salaam or Nairobi.
And without a second's hesitation, I said, okay, I'll go to Nairobi. And he said, well, that was really quick. You didn't even think. Why Nairobi? I said, I have no idea where Dar es Salaam even is. So I'll take Nairobi. I know that's in Kenya. And that's how I end up. That's the beginning of my life with Al-Qaeda, even though I, you know, didn't really know what Al-Qaeda was at that point.
Steve Godin had arrived at the chaotic site of the embassy bombing in Nairobi, working amid the rubble.
We get there and we get driven directly to the embassy. It was a long, slow ride. Streets were crowded. You could smell you could smell things still burning. The scene in front of the embassy was quite bizarre. It wasn't so much an investigative. It was all personal rescue at this point. Things were still on fire. People were trapped in the building. They were trying to get people out. It was mayhem. There had to be hundreds and hundreds of thousands of people in the street. God knows what was happening. And we certainly didn't. And I can remember us all standing in front of the embassy when we got off that bus with all our jaws just dropped.
He happened to end up with the biggest catch. He tracked down one of the bombers, an Al-Qaeda member who he interrogated in a Kenyan police headquarters.
We really hit it off on a personal level, I want to say. I was able to give him reasons why he should talk to us, and he provided an incredible confession with intricate detail of the people who were involved, both in Nairobi and Dar es Salaam, how he got involved with Al-Qaeda in the first place, and he also provided us with a significant phone number that led to an incredible amount of intelligence on Al-Qaeda's central communication system. And that phone number is 967-1200-578. I'll never forget that phone number because I testified about it so many times, but also because of the importance that it played. Anyone on our squads, squad I-45 or I-49, we would just call that the 578 number. His confessions, his naming names, even though a lot of the names were first names or kunias or war names, it was basically everything from how bin Laden picked me for this mission down to all the subunit leaders and commanders and people that became infamous after the Cole bombing and after the 9/11 attacks.
That 578 number would come to be known among Godin and his colleagues as the Al-Qaeda switchboard. It was one of the most essential pieces of intelligence the U.S. gathered in the years before 9/11. And it didn't take long, in fact, to prove O'Neill's hunch correct. Bin Laden had been behind the twin bombings of the embassies. President Bill Clinton gave a national address a few weeks later. It would likely be the first time many Americans heard the terrorist's name.
I ordered our armed forces to take action to counter an immediate threat from the Bin Laden network. Earlier today, the United States carried out simultaneous strikes against terrorist facilities and infrastructure in Afghanistan.
But the Clinton administration's move backfired in several ways. For one, U.S. forces obviously did not kill Osama bin Laden in 1998. Instead, they drove him further into Afghanistan and the supportive arms of the ruling Taliban. Plus, those names, bin Laden and al-Qaeda, didn't exactly stick in the nation's collective consciousness. Instead, Clinton was publicly accused of using the strikes to distract from the burgeoning Monica Lewinsky scandal. Across Washington, the hunt for bin Laden was seen as a sideshow, perhaps even a politically motivated one. But the FBI in New York, the agents of what came to be O'Neill's squads I-45 and I-49, knew in their hearts that the hunt for bin Laden was the real deal. Godin and his colleagues chased al-Qaeda around the world. He and a handful of other New York agents actually captured another one of the embassy bombers while working undercover in South Africa. And they worked to prepare to put the embassy bombers on trial in New York, even while al-Qaeda's attacks against the U.S. kept escalating. In October 2000, the terror group crashed a bomb-laden boat into a Navy ship.
First, as you know, an explosion claimed the lives of at least four sailors on one of our naval vessels, the USS Cole, this morning. The ship was refueling in a port in Yemen while en route to the Persian Gulf. If, as it now appears, this was an act of terrorism, it was a despicable and cowardly act. We will find out who was responsible and hold them accountable.
John O'Neill and his squad saw the pattern clearly. It was Yemen where he and Barbara Bodine clashed. No one, O'Neill felt, saw the urgency that he did. One of the other agents on the team was Ali Soufan, who, like O'Neill, was trying to ring the alarm bell before 9/11. Here's Soufan speaking on C-SPAN.
I think we got all the information that we can get from Yemen. We had one of the people who participated in the call attack admitting to us that he delivered an amount of $36,000 to Southeast Asia to Qaeda operatives over there. That information was passed to the other intelligence agencies of the United States, and we asked if anybody knew anything about it.
Soufan and O'Neill went to the CIA, who had their own investigation into al-Qaeda and bin Laden. CIA station chief Michael Scheuer actually had contact with a future terrorist leader in the 1980s when bin Laden was fighting against the Soviet invasion of Afghanistan. Since then, Scheuer and his team had been investigating the growing cell in Afghanistan. They'd actually launched something called Alex Station, the first time the CIA had ever focused on an individual. By the time of the Cole investigation, Scheuer had cultivated his own source within the terrorist network. Here's Scheuer speaking in 2008.
Bin Laden was not a Saudi ne'er-do-well. He was a hands-on, smart operator who had a long-term plan. He had an organization that was spread over at least four continents, including North America. And he had the desire to attack the United States. And probably most troublingly, in December 96, we found out he had organized a unit to try to acquire a nuclear weapon.
Bin Laden wasn't able to secure that nuclear bomb, but the CIA kept tracking him. And even though the agency and the FBI were chasing the same target, there was a big gap between the two. They had different approaches to investigations, different methods for gathering intel, and ultimately different priorities. Here's former Deputy Attorney General Jamie Gorelick. She looked at the domestic intelligence failures before the attacks for the 9/11 Commission.
You know, the CIA and the FBI are trying to do two different things. The CIA is trying to develop confidential sources from which it can get information. The FBI was trying to make criminal cases. Well, if you're making a criminal case, you are going to have to disclose the information that you have that led to the prosecution and that is the basis for the prosecution. That's anathema to a CIA agent who is trying to protect his sources and methods. So there are issues to be worked through. And reflexively, I think, people and their agencies don't do that. They retreat to their corners where they are comfortable that they can control the information that is important for them to do their jobs.
This tragic and ultimately fatal communication breakdown was the fruit of seeds planted decades before. In the 1970s, after President Richard Nixon's resignation.
In a televised farewell last night, President Nixon acknowledged that because of the Watergate affair, he no longer has a strong enough base in Congress to continue with any effectiveness.
The Watergate break-ins touched off years of scandal in Washington that laid bare decades of dirty business by the FBI and the CIA. Secret surveillance and blackmail of political opponents at home, assassinations and coups overseas.
Our history shows the American people will put up with a great deal, but they will not put up with anyone who claims to be or tries to be above the law.
In the wake of dozens of congressional hearings, Senate inquiries, and even indictments of top FBI and CIA leaders, Washington reformed the way the U.S. intelligence operated. Congress and the Attorney General recommended reforms that were, quote, designed to build a wall between federal law enforcement and the nation's intelligence community. It was meant to be a narrow protection, one that ensured material gathered by intelligence agencies without a warrant couldn't be used in criminal trials and prosecutions. But over the years, it calcified amid bureaucratic caution and risk-averse government lawyers. By the 1990s, the policy had grown into a giant chasm, an unbreachable divide that became known as the Chinese Wall. In reality, that meant that the CIA was reluctant to tell the FBI almost anything. For decades, the FBI and CIA grappled over the wall in a bureaucratic tug of war over resources and information. The two agencies would sometimes track the same suspects without telling each other. And ultimately, the policy, more than anything, became a way for U.S. intelligence agencies to hide information and protect sources from each other. Even within the FBI, agents working on national security matters couldn't talk to agents in the same office working similar criminal cases.
There were guidelines put in place that if the FBI's intelligence side collected information using some special laws and some special means of collection that are available on the national security side of things, that information couldn't necessarily be immediately passed over the wall to people working on criminal cases.
John O'Neill and Ali Soufan ran into the wall. They went to the CIA officials during the investigation into the 2000 bombing of the USS Cole in Yemen. They asked if the agency had intel on the Al-Qaeda network. Soufan gave the agency what the Bureau had: traced telephone calls, pictures of Al-Qaeda operatives, the 578 number. But the CIA told Soufan that they had nothing. The two organizations started bickering. O'Neill thought the CIA was withholding what they had, hiding behind that wall. But Michael Scheuer and the other CIA operatives accused FBI agents like O'Neill of being reckless. The CIA argued its officers would spend years cultivating witnesses and pulling threads. Then FBI agents like O'Neill would come in and destroy it all to make some public criminal case. The FBI was the bull in the CIA's delicate china shop. Here's Scheuer later testifying to Congress. He was asked about his relationship with O'Neill.
And John O'Neill, who was the FBI chief of counterterrorism, you had this to say about him. Mr. O'Neill was interested only in furthering his career and disguising the rank and competence of senior FBI leaders.
Yes, sir. I think I also said that the only thing, good thing that happened to America on 11 September was that the building fell on him, sir.
Okay.
But the CIA may have lied to O'Neill and Soufan. They had Al-Qaeda phone records and knew of an Al-Qaeda planning meeting in Malaysia. The terrorists were gathering to discuss something. And the CIA knew two people were at that meeting, Nawaf al-Hazmi and Khalid al-Midhar, two of the eventual September 11th hijackers. Over 3 days in January 2000, the CIA obtained film of that Al-Qaeda meeting in Asia, but they didn't have wiretaps with audio. If they did, officers would have likely heard about new ambitious plans to use hijacked planes as missiles. While the agency tracked the terrorists' location, the NSA was also tracing their calls. But the CIA didn't tell the FBI, who was also investigating Al-Qaeda, or the FAA, who could have put them on a no-fly list. So 8 days later, the two terrorists got on a plane using legal visas and passports and flew to the United States on January 15th, 2000. Back home, counterterrorism officials were steeling themselves for another attack. They didn't know what it would be or where, but they expected al-Qaeda to strike overseas. In response, the State Department stepped up security at its embassies. By this point, the CIA had been tipped off that the future hijackers had traveled to the United States. Here's former Senator Carl Levin, who passed away in August 2021, grilling then-CIA Director George Tenet.
My question is, do you know specifically why the FBI was not notified of that critical fact at that time?
The cable that came in from the field at the time, sir, was labeled information only, and I know that nobody read that cable.
But my question is, do you know why the FBI was not notified of the fact that an al-Qaeda operative now was known in March of the year 2000 yes. to have entered the United States? Why was the CIA, why did the CIA not specifically notify the FBI?
Sir, if we weren't aware of it, when it came in the headquarters, we couldn't have notified them. Nobody read that cable in the March timeframe.
Alarms finally started going off at the White House, too. On May 29th, Richard Clark, who'd worked closely with O'Neill on tracking bin Laden, wrote to National Security Advisor Condoleezza Rice to warn of more terrorist attacks. Quote, "When these attacks occur, as they likely will wonder what war we could have done to stop them." On August 6th, the threats finally reached the president. The CIA's presidential daily brief that day was headlined, "Bin Laden Determined to Strike in the U.S." 3 weeks before 9/11, in the New York FBI field office, one of Gauden and Soufan's colleagues, a special agent named Steve Bongard, had stumbled onto something. He was a hard-charging fighter pilot turned special agent for the New York office's Joint Terrorism Task Force. Bongard came across an email explaining that the two al-Qaeda operatives, al-Hazmi and al-Midhar, were in the country. He tried to get an investigation going, only to be told to stand down. He wasn't supposed to know that information because of the wall, so he couldn't act on it. A frustrated Bongard wrote to a colleague, "Show me where this is written that we can't have the intelligence. If this guy is in the country, it's not because he's going to fucking Disneyland." Making matters worse, during this back and forth, the FBI actually missed a critical piece of evidence. Al-Midhar had lied on his visa application. That meant that he was in the U.S. illegally and the Bureau could have opened a criminal investigation into his whereabouts. The 9/11 Commission later found that while the hijackers were in California, al-Midhar made regular calls to that 578 number. That's the al-Qaeda switchboard that Steve Gauden discovered in Nairobi. We know that the hijackers called it because the NSA and CIA were tracking them. But they didn't tell the New York FBI squads about al-Midhar. Had they, agents like Ali Soufan and Steve Gauden would have found out that the two were in regular contact with al-Qaeda. The same al-Qaeda terrorists behind the embassy and coal bombings.
And that would have been a good thing to know. I've said it, and I know others have said the same, that if John O'Neill knew, or John O'Neill had heard that, hey, we don't know how, we don't know why, but we think it might even be a misdialed number. Maybe it was a drunk college kid, thought he was calling Domino's for pizza, but in California, someone called the 578 number a couple times. John O'Neill wouldn't have died on September 11th. He would have had a heart attack and probably died from excitement trying to get to JFK, to get on a plane, to get to LAX back in 2000, to get to the bottom of who called that phone number, why, who lived at the house where that phone call originated from, who lived at that house 5 years ago, whoever looked at that house, whoever drove by that house, he would have got to the bottom. He would have made sure that his agents would have got to the bottom of that. That was a significant mess that no one, that wasn't exploited properly.
On or about August 25th, 2001, al-Hazmi and al-Midhar purchased their plane tickets for September 11th. As the al-Qaeda investigation stalled in 2001, so did O'Neill's career. He frequently butted heads with colleagues and chafed against the bureaucracy of the intelligence community. And he'd made some sloppy and potentially dangerous mistakes. At one point, he briefly lost track of an FBI briefcase that held classified information. And the job had taken a toll on his personal life. Over the course of the 1990s, he had separated from his wife, who raised their two children, and had long-term affairs with several women, simultaneously, unknown to each of them. He'd brought one of them to a secret FBI garage after his car had a mechanical problem. Another career black mark. Then he was passed over for the job he wanted more than any other, head of New York's flagship FBI field office. By the summer of 2001, those whispers of scandal, his well-documented clashes with superiors, and the need for higher pay drove O'Neill to retire from the bureau he loved. He took a high-paying job not far from the FBI's New York field office. In August 2001, he became the chief of security at the nearby World Trade Center. He left the FBI, even though he still believed that the next big Al-Qaeda attack was coming. So was the Chinese wall really the problem for counterterrorism officials, or just a convenient excuse? Yes, the CIA could have withheld that information in Al-Hazmi and Al-Midhar, but there's always been a lurking second theory. The U.S. didn't have a single meaningful intelligence source within Al-Qaeda by 2001. Was the CIA hoping that it could recruit and turn Al-Hazmi and Al-Midhar? Did it withhold their presence in the U.S. because it was hoping to turn them into CIA assets themselves? If so, the CIA ran out of time, and so did the United States. And so, as it turned out, did John O'Neill. The morning of September 11, 2001 was one of his first days on duty at his new job. O'Neill was last seen alive in the stairwell of the 48th floor of the South Tower, helping to evacuate people from the burning building.
And it was later that day I also found out that John had, we knew he had taken the job as the chief of security for the World Trade Center, but he hadn't had an office yet. And John being John, even though he didn't have a place to work, when those planes struck, he took it on himself to get down there in some way to try to help.
As O'Neill's body was buried beneath the rubble of the Twin Towers, FBI Special Agent Ali Soufan was preparing to return to the U.S. to investigate the attacks. But then he got a call from headquarters. They told him he was going to stay in Yemen. His new orders were to identify the people behind the plot by any means necessary. Soufan, initially, was confused. Why would he be leading the case from Yemen? Then a CIA officer approached Soufan and handed him a manila envelope. It contained pictures of the Al-Qaeda planning meeting in Kuala Lumpur. Pictures of the men that Soufan had been investigating. The men involved in the USS Cole bombing. And with them were 9/11 hijackers Nawaf Al-Hazmi and Khalid Al-Midhar. There, in front of Soufan, was the connection between Al-Qaeda, the USS Cole, and 9/11, the intel that he had been requesting from the CIA for months. Soufan today remains convinced the FBI would have put the pieces together and stopped the terrorists if they had got this info on time. The Chinese wall had fallen, one day too late to make a difference. Soufan later said that he was so disgusted upon getting that intelligence that he ran to the bathroom and vomited. Ali Soufan left the bureau in 2005, but he maintains that the intelligence failures before 9/11 were not the fault of one person or institution. Here's Soufan speaking at the World Trade Center in 2018.
I look at the event before 9/11 very differently, and I was living it, than I look at the event after 9/11, because after 9/11, it was a death of innocence for me. After 9/11, I knew that I was sitting with people asking for information about individuals, and the people in our government knew that they were here in the United States, and they didn't tell me about it until they flew freaking planes to these buildings. If information was shared to the FBI team investigating the USS Cole, you know, was shared on a timely basis, 9/11 could have been stopped at its early stages. We need accountability. Guess what, folks? We didn't have an accountability for 9/11. The people who were pointed at by all the investigations that they are to be held legally responsible for 9/11, Those people later gave the administration what they want, and they took us to a war in Iraq. And instead of being held accountable, they got a freaking medal.
In our next episode, you'll hear about the quest to bring those responsible for the September 11th attacks to justice. We have the story of the alleged 20th hijacker of 9/11. But were there actually more? A 21st? Maybe even a 22nd? The answer involves the darkest chapter of the U.S. response to 9/11 and the Navy base at Guantanamo Bay, Cuba.
His treatment met the legal definition of torture. It was abusive and uncalled for and coercive, clearly coercive.
Long Shadow is a production from Goat Rodeo and Longlead. You can find it wherever you get your podcasts. Go ahead and rate the show and leave us a review. It helps spread the word. I'm your host, Garrett Graff. Long Shadow's lead producer is Max Johnston. John Patrick Pullen is the show's executive producer. The episode was written by me and Max. Story editing from Morgan Springer. Editorial support from Dan Eisner, Diana Albasha, and Owen O'Carroll. Senior producers at Goat Rodeo are Megan Nadolsky and Ian Enright. Rebecca Seidel is managing producer. Music from Blue Dot Sessions and Ian Enright. Podcast artwork by Emily Crawford. Longlead's creative director is Natalie Matuszewski. And a thanks to ABC, CBS, NBC, PBS, C-SPAN, and the 9/11 Memorial and Museum for some of the archival audio you hear on the show.